This is the start of the October 9th, 1986 interview with retired fisherman and seafood company owner George Kervin. The interview is conducted at Kervin's home on St. George Island, Florida. The interviewer is David Taylor, and this interview is done in connection with the Maritime Heritage Survey Project.
Could you just say a few words and then I'll play it back to see if it's recording properly?
Well, my name is George Kervin. I've lived in Franklin County ever since the year of 1926. I was 17 years old. I came here with my dad and have been in the seafood business all of my life. I was captain of a commercial fishing boat producing approximately from a million and a half to 2,486,000, I think, was my biggest day year of fin fish. And I made a study of Apalachicola Bay. I've had a lot of help. I've listened to a lot of very knowledgeable people, such as Dr. Engel, the Department of Natural Resource, DNR. It's been a great help to me. And then the old-timers had spent a life studying the bay, and some things I didn't agree with them on, but then again I put their knowledge with what knowledge I had as a young man, and I grew up in the seafood business. I was captain of a large fishing boat, and I studied the bay, and the bay was good to me. The people of Franklin County was good to me. I can say that I believe, from a layman's standpoint, there's no man that's ever been on the bay that knows as much about the bay, the flow of the tide, the work of the fish, studying the weather from my observation of a fisherman. I contribute this to the great success that the Kervins has had in Franklin County. We came to Franklin County and we didn't have a lot of this world's goods, but we were willing to work. Mm-hmm. And we came here because after studying the bay and looking at the bay, we decided it was the richest bay in natural resources there was anywhere in the United States. And us being in the seafood business, we felt like this was the place for us. There was opportunity here for us to make a good living and make a success. And also, since that time, I have been in it. I was actually captain of a commercial fishing boat up until 1961. My brother and I, which was in Kervin Brothers Seafood, we decided to dissolve partnership, not that we disagreed on anything except our boys had grew up and there was just not enough money in the business for all concerned. So we decided to divide and dissolve our partnership, and he remained on in Kervin Brothers Seafood, and I went into Quality Seafood with my son after he had got out of college, he'd graduated, came out of school, and so he and I went in business together at the site where Quality Seafood is now, and we went into this shrimp business, and from that into the oyster business. We had a dry dock, and then from that we went into the clam business. And we had three different companies. One was Kervin Marine Ways and Fisheries. The other was Kervin and Sons Incorporated, and the other was Quality Seafood. We divided our business for business reasons. And so when one was up, one was down, the other was up. Mm-hmm. And so it worked out very, very good. From 61 until 78, when I retired, I was managed and was president of the corporation and Quality Seafood and Kervin and Sons Incorporated. And So it worked out very good, and I can say of the truth, the bank was good to me. I'd have to mention G. Rodman Porter, who was president of the bank. And he often told me, he said, "George, what you want," he said, "don't mind asking for it." And I've been the type of person, and this is what I tell my our younger people: set your goals high. Never settle for something common. Set your goals high. I was challenged in the JCs by a great man who was Colonel McLeod, who was an attorney. And he was making a talk to the Junior Chamber of Commerce. And he said these words, and they always stuck with me, and I was young then, not then. He said, "Never before in the history of this nation has a young man or a young woman had the opportunity to do something and make something of himself and do something for his country as you have right now." You got a life ahead of you. And you know, I never forgot that. That was a great challenge to me. And so my dad always worked in that direction and advised us in that direction. So I was a great hand at setting goals. I never looked at my bank account a whole lot. Because when I set goals and worked to those goals, and I never failed to reach a goal that I set, well, the money always taking care of itself. It always come in. And so I'm proud of my record in Franklin County, that I contributed to a lot of other people, a lot of help. My son especially, when he got out of school, he had the education. My daughter had the education. They came into the business. As a part owner in the business, I shared the business with them. And later on, my part in 82, I sold out to my son, Bobby Kurgan, who was one of the largest shrimp dealers is in, along the west coast of Florida. And of course, I was in the shrimp, oyster, clam business, and we shut those down because Bobby felt that there was the best money was in the shrimp business. He wanted to give all of his time and all to the shrimp business. And so due to my health, I had to get out of it. So we closed the oyster business down, which involved a lot of liability. A lot of people. I worked about 175 to 200 people in the oyster business and in the shrimp business and in the clam business. And but we shut those down, and when I retired, and which was actually in 78 that we cut those down. And you might ask me any questions that you would like to ask me. I was honored in 1965 by the Governor's Award and the convention down in St. Petersburg that they called me and sent me a check for all of my expenses and said, "We want you in St. Petersburg on a certain day." So I went, and it was a convention. And they presented me with an award, and I had never really kept account of the things that I had accomplished. When I set a goal and I reached it, that was behind me. I set a greater goal, another goal, and worked toward that. So anyhow, they named off in a number of things that I had been interviewed by other people, and they had checked the records in Tallahassee. And of course, they found I was the largest mullet producer, finfish producer in the state of Florida. I had planted more oyster shell in the bay for farming and growing oysters than any other one individual. Or at least I say one individual, one concern. which was quality seafood. And one of the great things that I'm proud of, that there's such a hassle today, and it upsets me, and that's between the commercial fishermen and the sports fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
Upon the record that I had, they told me, they said, "Mr. Craven, never have we have any record where you have ever disagreed or had any clash with a sports fisherman. Not on the fishing ground, neither in the legislature. You was always argued there was room for both industries if we worked together
mm-hmm.
and worked to one another's interest. You have been found to help the sports fishing people. They have been found in turn to help you. And you have a reputation of getting along with people. And I'm proud of that. This is one of the things that I have my award there at Mother Home in Apalachicola, and it was Hayden Burns that presented me with the award to Randolph Hodges, which has always made me feel mighty good. I was honored by being asked to be King Retso last year at our Seafood Festival. And enjoyed that, and I counted it a great honor to represent the oyster industry. And I'm proud of life as I look back over life. You know, when you're young, you're looking all the time to the future. You're
mm-hmm.
setting goals,
mm-hmm.
and if you're not setting goals, you're going to be a common labor man.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get any work. But if you set your goals, work toward them, honest, upright, and live in such a way that you gain the respect of people. I often reminded in my young days of a statement made by Abraham Lincoln. He said, "I'd love to see a man that is proud of the community in which he lives. In turn, I like to see a man that the community is the proud of the man that lives there."
Mm-hmm.
And this, I have tried to pattern my life by this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud of life. I don't know how much longer I have to live. I hope a long time. But I will always work for the betterment of all people. I've never asked a politician. I've always been very much involved in politics, to not be directly involved in politics.
Mm-hmm.
I've never asked a politician to lay on the line something that would benefit myself. I've always said, you listen to me, and listen to me carefully. And then you listen to all the other people in the same industry. And then I'm expecting you to have enough judgment to put it all together and come up for what is best for all of the people that you represent.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I feel today.
Mm-hmm.
If you would like to ask me any questions
okay.
in a particular way, you just...
Fine. Well, we've gone over your life, all your years, in about 10 minutes here, and given me a good summary. I wanted to go back and ask you some more specific questions about your experiences. First of all, can you tell me where you were born?
Yes, I was born in Bay County at a little place they call Orba, up about 15 miles this side of Panama City, right where Tyndall Field sits now. That's where I was born and raised until I was 16 years old. When I was 16 years old, my dad got interested in the seafood business, and he felt that we had come from time to time and studied the bay, as I told you before, found it to be rich, great opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved to Franklin County, to Apalachicola, in 1926, when I was, actually I was a 16-year-old boy at that time.
Had your father or you done any fishing before that time?
Well, my dad had never did any fishing. My dad was a truck farmer, a cattleman, and a preacher,
mm-hmm.
country preacher.
Oh, yeah.
Is right. I had a fine mother, Christian home, and of course, as my two older brothers and myself grew up, we went to away from home and started fishing with our uncles, the Raphael brothers.
Oh, yes.
Who they were counted the top fishermen, and we fished for them for some time until our dad saw that it appeared that we were wasting our time. We would always be a hard man, subject to be fired or whatever. So he said, boys, if you think you can handle it, I'd like to put in a same boat, commercial fishing boat, equal to any of the other boats.
Mm-hmm.
So he put in a boat by the name of Miss Steffi, a beautiful boat and a very fast boat. And so we became very competitive to the old timers, and we were very salty. You know, all of the successful captains had to be very salty, take the weather most as it comes, you know, and rough weather. And that's when it seems that the fish runs best, when she gets rough. And too rough for most people. The people that's salty enough to be out there and go ahead and take the chances and all, he is the one that usually makes a success.
Mm-hmm.
So we become very competitive, and so to keep down family feelings and among most of the people that we had worked with, we began to look at Apalachicola. And me and my brother, Jesse Curvin, older brother, we taken a gill net, and we came over here. Now, we were not gill net fishermen, but we were seine fishermen. And we taken the gill net to just explore the bay. We could do that without much cost.
Mm-hmm.
And when we explored the bay, and all after several months studying it and looking at it, we came up with the ideas I've said before, that we can make some money here. We can make some money in Apalachicola Bay. It's rich. It's plentiful. And there was a bounty of all kind of seafood, mullet, trout, flounder, shrimp, oysters, and you name it, that we had it. It was plentiful.
Mm.
Was right. We had the willingness to work and the knowledge to, at least the ability to seek understanding and to try to learn more about the bay. And so we made a lot of study of it. Mm-hmm. Very good to us.
Mm-hmm. What was Apalachicola like when you came at that time?
Apalachicola was a very busy town. For the lack of conservation and for the lack of seeing into the future, when I came to Apalachicola Bay, there was three banks here operating here. There was five big processing plants, which was canning and cooking and canning oysters and shrimp. And there was, I believe, three large sawmills that cut only cypress lumber. And it was a booming town. Money was flowing everywhere. That's right. I don't know how many bar rooms we had, but on a Saturday night, it was dangerous to get around what we call the Bowery, because unless you wanted to fight, you better move on. So mm-hmm. we didn't cater to that part of town very much. You know, we were church-going people, and we immediately united to the church. And of course, my daddy was a preacher. He never preached as a pastor in Apalachicola. But we went directly into the seafood business. We set up Apalachia Seafood Company.
Mm-hmm.
And then my brother and I, we were the producers, the harvesters. And my dad was the salesman. He was the dealer that managed the company.
Mm-hmm.
So we produced the fish. My dad, he then in turn processed and sold the fish, and we were very successful at it. until the year of 1945, he went on to be with the Lord and passed away. It left my brother and I. And of course, one of us had to take his place. One of us had to go on the hill. So my brother was older than I. And I felt like I was a better fisherman than he was. I could beat him. I felt like he'd be a better businessman than I was, because he could easily say no. I was always prone to listen to a person and possibly say yes when I shouldn't say no, with my better judgment. So anyhow, after that, we went out of that business and went into Cribbin Brothers Seafood and handling finfish all together. We handled up in the finfish. And I was a producer, and the boat that he was fishing, we trained a man by the name of Q.P. Golden, one of as fine a men as I ever knew. And we trained him to fish the boat that my brother had been fishing while my father was on the scene. And so we worked together by communication, by radio, you know, and stayed in touch with one another. And we were very successful. My largest catch of fish was 436,000 pounds of catfish, sea cat, which I got a permit from DNR from Randolph Hodges, who was executive director of the Department of Natural Resource and a great man, a wonderful man. And he gave us a permit to hold those fish for 3 months, or as long as it taken to put them on the market without glutting the market. So anyhow, we put them in a body of water down here known as Nick's Hole, which is a pretty large body of water. And we undertaken to feed them. I put a man and his wife there on a boat stationed there to keep other people from molesting them anyway. And we undertaken to feed those fish. And this is one of the things that I won my governor's award by. I was the first man in the state of Florida to undertake penning fish and feeding fish and putting them on the market as a market called for them.
Well, how did you first catch them, and how did you keep them enclosed, and how did you put them in that place to begin with?
Well, I found the fish, and of course this was something that from year to year that I got on to, that the catfish, these large pools of catfish come in out of the Gulf at a certain, on a certain moon change, and it was, they was just like on clockwork, they were there. And they, of course, they use the middle of the bay, and I had my seine about 1,400 yards long and the best equipment that money could buy. The name of my boat was the Four Kids, named after my four children, one son and three daughters. And we would strike those fish out into the middle of the bay, and of course it was not allowed to purse seine, however we was not in the purse seine fishing business. And then they, we would head them in the direction of some inlet, some body of water that we could put them in. My first year, I caught 120,000, the first year that I put food on them. The second year, I caught 240,000. And then the third year, I made my big set, which was 434,000 in that school of fish. And of course, when I sat on them, I was right at the turn buoy of the intercoastal waterway. When you go up that Blatchcool River, that's where they were laying. I sat on them about sundown. We towed all night long and had to work with the current. And we swept way down the bay off of Pilot Cove as the tide fell, and during the night the tide turned in, we swept back up the bay. But all the time I had my eyes on Nick's Hole. That's where I was going to put them. And so about sunup, we brought them to the mouth of it. And of course, when they found that there was an inlet, see, I had to keep them with a speedboat. I had to keep them flushed back from the Seine to keep them from lifting the Seine and going
mm-hmm.
under.
Mm-hmm.
Then in turn, they would get started to go on ashore, and they would go faster than what we could tow the Seines.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have to go around and flush them back into the Seine,
mm-hmm.
doing so. But then when we made beach and made shore, and they made their flush to get out of the Seine to go ashore, they went right up into this big body of water, which
mm-hmm.
I guess is 50 acres in it, and it's all averaging about 4 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
We put them there, and then we got a permit from the Department of Natural Resource to hold them and feed them. And we kept them there a little over 3 months, and the market didn't know we had them. And we never froze one. But
mm-hmm.
when my brother in town would get an order, I left a man and his wife there to watch the fish, and I went right ahead with my normal fishing,
mm-hmm.
producing just as many fish as I'd produced at all. And during the day, he would call me and say, George, I've got an order for 40,000, I've got an order for 20,000 or 30. Well, then we would go up into Nick's Hole, and we would, they were like sheep. You could run your boat through them and cut off as many of them as you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And we cut off what we were doing, all the proximity, and then we ran them into a large bag and pulled them alongside of the boat, bailed them in, had them bailed and used in 40, 50 minutes, and headed for town. And we fed them for the first 2 weeks. I carried all the scrap fish in there, and they was just like a bunch of hogs, you might say. They just take them to it, and they would follow the boat and the men shoveling the stuff overboard. But after about a couple of weeks, the fish put off a grease that floated and drifted out into the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And by nature, there was millions, literally millions of little small fish about this size that started sucking on this grease
mm-hmm.
that was on top
mm-hmm.
of the water. And on a falling tide, this grease would flow out into the bay, and on a building tide, it would shrink back up. These little fish just kept swimming until they came through the net that we had to cut off, which was a heavy piece of seine webbing that
mm-hmm.
we had to cut off. And they went right into the catfish, and the catfish just went to grabbing them and eating them.
Hmm.
And the fish was cutting out 56 pound out of 100 pound. Whenever you cut their heads off, just back of the dorsal fin, and then taking their insides
mm-hmm.
out, then you had 56 pound of pure meat,
mm-hmm.
and that's what you sold.
Mm-hmm.
And when we put them in there, that's what they were cutting out. And with all those little munners that came in there, and they fed on them, they got fat as pigs. And in 3 months, they were cutting out 63 pound. They had gained 7 pound to 100. They were
that's great.
Is right. And then right in the last of my fishing, just before I retired, of course, I had invented my own mechanical system of hauling seine. You didn't do it by power, you meant manpower.
Mm-hmm.
You did it by winches and hauled a seine up. You got them scrouged down to a small place, and then you took it over by hand and caught them. And I learned under permit I could hold mullet. Now, mackerel, you cannot hold them. Bluefish, you cannot hold them. They die. But mullet, you can hold mullet, just like you could hold pompano, of course, as you know. They've had pompano farms down the state.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hold mullet for weeks, and I would catch large catches of fish, and the market would be bad. And so I would hold them in an enclosure and stake the seine up, or at least the piece of the seine I had for it, and those fish become regular pets.
Hmm.
And then I put on the market what the market would take, mm-hmm. my brother would.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had these fish in reserve. When he got another order, all I had to do is go, if I couldn't find them somewhere else, just go and pick them out of them.
Hmm.
And this is lawful. Mm-hmm. Stop netting is unlawful.
Right. Excuse me just a minute, I'll turn this over. Okay.
Now then, would you like to ask me another question?
Yeah, I'm very interested in knowing from you a little bit about how you learned how to find fish. What sorts of things in nature did you look at, or what other means did you use to help you locate fish in the water?
Well, of course, this is something that you just learned from the older timers. When you was I was a boy, and I got on the boats with my uncles and all, then they didn't teach me as far as teaching me. But I was interested enough to I saw what they saw,
mm-hmm.
and I picked it up. And of course, different kind of fish, you locate them differently. Mullet, most of the time you find them by them jumping out of the water. And then in heavy bunches of fish, you locate them by color. They'll have a color in the water and a ripple on top of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, your trout, you find them usually under birds. Birds will be feeding over them. Or either one, you find them by looking for them on the bottom, mud streaks on the bottom. They're bottom fish, they're on the bottom. And then you become to know where their bedding place is at, where it's the best place to find them, on what kind of a tide to expect them to be there, on what kind of a moon change you know they're going to be there,
mm-hmm.
on what kind of a wind direction you know they're going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And this all comes into the picture of being able to catch them when they're there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always when you can find fish that you can catch the fish.
Mm-hmm.
You have got to find them, and you've got to find them under the conditions to where you can catch them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you just make a study of this. It's hard for me to tell you,
mm-hmm.
or tell anyone else. But this is something that you, what makes good fishermen and bad fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
Good fishermen study it, and they know how it's done, and they do it. The poor fishermen, they never study it, and they never make a success at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's mackerel, bluefish, and all. Most of those fish are caught at night. And of course, you see them in the phosphorus. There's a fire in the water. There's any disturbance in the water, you can see the kind of see the fish down there. And you have to learn and know the way the fish runs and how he runs to know what kind of a fish he is, because there's all kind of fish out there in that water.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the trash fish, the pogies, the menhaden, and all of this stuff, you know the commotion they make in the water, so you know not to settle.
Hmm.
Skipjacks and stuff of this kind, you know that he is going to, when you hit him, he's going straight offshore. And your mackerel, when you hit them, they flash, they scare. They go in every direction,
mm-hmm.
is right. You know mackerel by the figuration in the water.
Hmm.
You know the bluefish, because a bluefish is the type of fish that will run with you, with the boat. When you hit him, he runs with the boat. But don't never be fooled. The moment you get out of him, he turns right around the opposite direction and goes just as fast as he can in the opposite direction. That's the reason most fishermen miss catching fish. They don't know the direction they're going to run, so they strike at them where they're laying when they see them.
Hmm.
And they're not there no more. They're done gone.
Hmm.
That's right. A great experience that I had and that caused me to have great respect for people that make a study, a scientific study of our waters, our the fish. We used to have two fellers that came through, and I don't know the place that they were from. Only it was a marine lab in Miami at the mm-hmm. time, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of controversy on catching all the fish up.
Mm-hmm.
I've always found in my life experience that fish is like your wildlife of all kind. They work in cycles. And fish, I've always found that they will disappear and they will become very scarce. And over a period of about 7 years, they began to build back, and then at the end of that 7 years, you got more fish than you've ever had before, and you really don't know where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it reaches that peak, then there's a dropping off back for about 7 years, and it works in these cycles. I think your wildlife of all kind works in these kind of cycles. Of course, conservation has mm-hmm. great to do with it, and misuse in the industry has some to do with it, but it all works in cycles to a great extent.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And any other questions?
Yeah. What are the main fish and shellfish species that are harvested and marketed from this bay?
Well, the largest industry now is the shrimp industry. That brings more money to Franklin County than any other seafood industry we have. What accounts for this is our boats, the type boats we have built. And I say they're second to none, and being seaworthy and going all over the Gulf. They search the Gulf. Wherever the shrimp is at, they go to where the shrimp is at. And they bring them back to Apalachicola to be processed most of the time. And for the lack of conservation, when we first went into the shrimp business, our boats very seldom went further than Capes and Blasts to the west and Cedar Keys to the east.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had better conservation on our nursery grounds. But then as the years has gone by, politics has become more effective and give in to the block vote, the majority vote, and I don't mind being quoted on this anywhere. And they have allowed them to catch the little baby shrimp on our nursery grounds. And it's nature that when a shrimp, if I understand it right, when he rolls, he's out in about 10 fathom of water. That's when he spawns. Mm-hmm. That's your white shrimp. Now remember, your white shrimp and your brown shrimp is a local shrimp. Your pink shrimp or your hopper, most people call them, they migrate. They come from the east and go west in the spring of the year. We have a few of them raised here, but our main shrimp here is the white shrimp and then the brown shrimp. And of course, those shrimp go offshore, they spawn, and when the little prong comes like this in the moss and grass, it gradually drifts ashore, and they make their way back to the beaches, they go right on back into the bays, they go right on back into the marshlands, and there they live until they begin to grow up. When they begin to grow up to get a little larger, they begin to venture out a little further into deeper water. And by nature, they remain in the bay, unless you have severe cold in the winter. They remain in the bay until they'll leave the bay when they are up on about 40, 50 count shrimp. They'll mm-hmm. begin leaving the bay. But they leave the nursery ground, which is a shallower part of the bay. They live there and they begin to sift out as it grows. The small shrimp will remain on the nursery ground. The larger shrimp will begin to move out from them and move out on it in the southern part of the bay, the deeper part of the bay. I have a map in there that will make it much more simple and understanding. I had worked hard to get the nursery ground closed, both for the shrimp business and also for the oyster industry, because when you drag shrimp nets over oyster beds, you're destroying the oyster beds. You're destroying the little flounder. You're destroying the little speckled trout. You're destroying the little redfish. You're destroying the crabs. You're destroying what it's all about in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked hard to get our nursery grounds closed to commercial shrimping. And I failed to do it. And that was running parallel with the Intercoastal Waterway from Patton Bridge west. And I offered to take my own equipment and set the piling and all and furnish the piling. And when you turn the Intercoastal Waterway going up the river, extend that same course right on across to St. Vincent's Dry Bar.
Mm-hmm.
Close St. Vincent Sound right on down to Indian Pass and close all of that water north of this line that I have just drawn. And
mm-hmm.
before you leave, I'll show you
sure.
the map there. And I got DNR to work with me on it. In fact, Dr. Engel, whenever I bought an oyster lease, oyster leasing is outlawed ever since 1958, I believe it was, that Oliver Nash was representative, catering to the majority of votes. He got a law passed that you could not lease bottom private leasing in Apalachicola Bay, a bay that today is thought of as a depressed area, at least the county, and then a bay that'll grow an oyster faster than any bay waters in the nation, and I would venture to say in the world. And there's less than 4% of them that's the bottom of our bay that's commercial oyster beds. This is a survey that's been made by DNR.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's 47% that say is ideal for planting.
Mm-hmm.
And after sounding the whole bay, walking over much of the bay myself, I say that the bottom of the bay could be 85% of it could be planted by making a heavier foundation.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you explain that to me about what planting is about and how you make a foundation?
Well, let's stay on this.
Okay, sure.
On the shrimp.
Yeah.
This there and our nursery ground.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, in the I had the lease, and so I found it successful. The greatest success that I could have was to get a good coverage on my bottom,
mm-hmm.
because the oysters that is exposed to the surface of the water, they're the only ones that the spat will catch to.
Mm-hmm.
If they're 18 inches deep and a barge load of oyster shell, bleached oyster shell, will cover a quarter of an acre, well, you get an area there that the spat can catch to, wherein if you pile them up in piles, reaching at that time, they would pile them up clean out of the water. And all your barge load of shell would only cover places to 2 yards across, you know,
mm-hmm.
and all the depth of that water was wasted shell.
Mm-hmm.
And as I started to say, I went to Dr. Engel, and I told him, I said, he was in charge of planning the oysters estate planning program. I said, Dr. Engel, why don't you spread your shell? I said, you're wasting these shells, you're piling them up in piles, they go down out and just spud the old barge down, and then they blow them overboard on each side, and then they move back, get another load.
Mm-hmm.
I said, why don't you spread them like I do? You get so much more coverage. You'll make, get 10 times the production off of the same amount of shell. He said, George, I know you're right. This is truth. However, he said, as long as you allow the shrimp boats to drag over these beds, he said, we're defeated. We're whipped.
Mm-hmm.
He said, he said, you are in a position as a private enterprise to stake your lease, put a watchman on it, keep him there day and night, and keep these shrimpers from dragging over. In fact, I had stakes close enough together they couldn't get between it.
Mm-hmm.
You see, with the spread of the net.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, the state, we cannot afford to keep a man out there and watching. Now, he said, if you will get the north side of this bay closed to shrimping, which will be in protection of the shrimp, and will also be in protection of the oysters, he said, I'll show you how to grow oysters.
Hmm.
He said, this north side of this bay will come back. And he said, it will have flounder. We'll have a fish like we had 50 years ago. And he said, we will increase our shrimp industry by many folds. And the shrimp will grow up larger, and they'll be harvested and sell for a much better price. And the tonnage will be increased. So it was a challenge to me to try to get the north side of the bay closed. And if you'll cut this off just a minute. Should be a warning, maybe. The second offense, it should be $500. The third offense, I think they had ought to confiscate his gear, take his gear away from him, his license to fish in the bay, and make him go to carpentering and doing whatever he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
Make it strong enough. And this is what will bring our bay back, the oyster industry back,
mm-hmm.
and planting the bay is right.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, yeah.
Any questions?
I'm from parts that of the country where oystering is not a big thing, and I haven't been exposed to this industry and its techniques before. I'd like to know a little bit more about the yearly activities of oystermen around here, when they go out, when they don't go out, and what they do on an average day to harvest oysters.
Well, the oysterman as a whole, now I was in the oyster business for 16 years that I run an oyster house, and it was the largest one in West Florida. I had 65 stalls, worked about 45 men on the boats, and from 50 to 65 women. I had 65 stalls, some of them sometimes was vacant. But from 50 to 65 stalls, and those men work hard, and of course they're. I interviewed every person that worked at my place. I didn't just let anyone come that would like to have come to Quality Seafood. He had to be a sober, honest, hardworking man in order to work at Quality Seafood. And so doing so both by both men and women, no drinking, I allowed no drinking. The better people seem to cater to Quality Seafood because of this environment.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the oystermen usually went out on the morning of about 8 o'clock, and they worked on the bars until about summer. They'd start coming in from 2 o'clock in the afternoon until dark, and sometime many of them would come in after dark. The harder workers would come in after dark. And they had to catch a good oyster. I weighed my every fifth bag, and the oyster bag had to weigh 60 pounds. I didn't take from one man and give to another.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. which if you don't weigh them, you do that. And then the ladies that did the shucking was housewives and fine people, family, fine people. And they worked hard. Most of them would come in from 6 o'clock in the morning and start shucking. From then to 8 o'clock, they would be coming in, and they had their own particular stall that they worked in, don't you see? And the oysters actually at that point were theirs until they brought them and passed them through a conveyor type place there to where they went into what we call the washroom, and we washed them, and then of course we wrote them a ticket for them and for the oystermen. Mm-hmm. The last 5 years of my working in the oyster industry, we turned to what we call blanching oysters. We worked about the same amount of oystermen, but we only worked about 32 women, because those 32 women could shuck more oysters by blanching them and shock treatment to open them up than they could over in the old shucking house, you know, shucking them like they were shucking them by 65 women working, you see. So we stepped up our production, and it was very successful. And why that someone hasn't gone into it, I still can't understand. I don't know why they haven't. It costs quite a bit of money to get into it. You've got to build your conveyors. I worked hard for a patent, and would have got a patent if it hadn't been for my... I got sick during the main time and had to buy out of it. But my system was quite different to the shock treatment that they use up north. They call the Hank something patent. He has a patent on shock treatment, and mm-hmm. that process works. He brings the oysters in, and then they are dumped into a vat of hot water, which is about 180 degrees. And they come out of that vat and drop into a vat of tap water.
Mm-hmm.
And they shock between the 180 degrees and I would say the whatever temperature, probably 60, 70, 80 per, degree temperature, mm-hmm. the shock between those things would cause them to gap open.
Mm.
And then they was conveyed out on a table and the shuckers would shuck them. And I went over in the Carolinas where they was operating this thing, and then I went, they had one down here at, out from St. Augustine, a little small place. I went there. And I looked at it, but the oysters was more or less a pre-cooked oyster.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did that for 1 year, and I was selling them on the fresh market. And I had trouble with the oyster cocktails. Now, for cooking, for frying, mm-hmm. and all, they were delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And they gained about 20% gain on yield, mm-hmm. by this operation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had studied it, and I knew that CO2 would kill oxygen in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And a good friend of mine, who is Roger Newton, he had experimented with this on scallop. And so I tried it on oysters. And sure enough, about just take CO2 and put it into tap water and put your oysters in for so many minutes, about 60% of them will gap.
Mm-hmm.
The others will not gap.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that with the shock treatment reversed to what the Hank patent called for, would leave the oyster in a to where you could be sold on the market fresh. So what I did, I built a large cooler. My son, now when I say I'm talking
right.
about our family,
mm-hmm.
I built a large cooler that would store about 1,000 bushels of oysters. And I had the compressors on that to where we could pull it down overnight to approximately 32 degrees. The oysters are exposed on the outside a lot of time, but have just little shivers of ice in them. But the oysters deeper down in it, you know, that the cold couldn't get to. But as you took off, they continued to get cold, you know, as mm-hmm. you moved them off.
Mm-hmm.
They came out of the cooler, and they went over a conveyor that had high-pressure jets washing them. Of all silt.
Mm-hmm.
There was one manifold underneath the conveyor and one on top of the conveyor that under pressure it knocked all of the silt, everything off of mm-hmm. the mud and everything mm-hmm. went down through just as clean. And they dropped into a 100 instead of 180 degrees, they dropped into a 120 degree temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And down at the in the bottom of that vat, I had a manifold that I was injecting CO2 into it continuously. The bubbles were just
mm-hmm.
solid
mm-hmm.
all over it, you see. This killed the oxygen in the water, and the oysters immediately gulped when you dropped him in there. And then we run him out on the table instead of running with the old steaming system, we'd run out 40, 50 bushels. But with the CO2 system, we would run out with 10 and 15 bushels mm-hmm. in order to get them shut before they close back up.
I see. Yeah.
He'd close back
uh-huh.
up. And then you could throw him back overboard and he'd live right on.
Hmm.
And then you could take him to the blower, blow him, or sell him on the fresh market for cocktails or whatever. He was just like the fresh mm. oyster.
Great.
And that is the patent that I tried to get. I have the papers I can mm-hmm. show you. Go through it there. And so anyhow, there is tremendous opportunity here in the oyster business. First of all, in the farming, and working the bottom and planning the bottom, and much of it would become public bottom, much of it would be private bottom by getting a law to where we can have private leasing. And then the next thing is by harvesting the ways of harvesting oysters. I'm very much opposed to dredging oysters. This is a dredge where you drag oysters, break the bills off of them, pull them off in the mud. I'm opposed to that. But I have went up on Chesapeake Bay, Delaware River, and Anacoke River, Long Island Sound. I've been all over those places up there to try to learn something more about what would I could improve my business and make more money
mm-hmm.
at it.
Mm-hmm.
So I found up there that they were using hydraulic tongs. I guess you're probably familiar with this.
I've heard of those, yeah.
Hydraulic tongs. When I got sick, I was in the process of bringing about four of them, sets of them down and mounting them on boats and getting into that.
Mm-hmm.
Into that. But because there's no law against it. There's law against dredging,
mm-hmm.
but there's no law against power tonging.
Hmm.
And one man, by working two little levers, about as long as that pencil there, can put more oysters on deck than five men can cull.
Mm-hmm.
Now, up there, they have passed laws that on public bottom, they can only work 4 hours out of the day.
Mm-hmm.
But they have one man right there at the controls that picks up five bushels of oysters, and he can control the pressure he puts on the bottom. And he can catch a much better oyster because he just skims the top of the
mm-hmm.
oysters.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't go down into the bed, don't you see, and disturb the bed.
Right.
He gets the larger oysters, he throws them up on the deck, one-man operation with the hydraulic tongs. Then there's five men there tonging, trying to keep up with him, and they don't beat and all to try to get all every little oyster and everything that they might get by with the law, but they just pick the largest oysters out, throw the rest of it back overboard,
mm-hmm.
and work as fast as they can, and they get a much better quality oyster, larger oyster.
Hmm.
That works other places. It can work right here in Apalachicola Bay.
Mm-hmm.
The conchs, now this is all pertaining to the oysters. The conchs in this bay is one of our worst predators.
Hmm.
When they build the Jim Woodruff Dam, I know you're familiar with our seafood festival.
Sure.
When they built the Jim Woodruff Dam, the people of Franklin County, I was here as a kind of a young person, and the people of Franklin County was thinking in terms of if they put dams on the river and they had made it navigational for large boats, that they could go to Columbus, Georgia, they'd come down, have large warehouses here on both sides of the river, and the town would boom, and Franklin County would boom, and then the stuff would be shipped out, cotton and all of this, to all parts of the world.
Continued on tape 2.